this is very serious, but I don't want to even entertain the idea that it could possibly be cancer. You know, nobody wants to accept the big C because growing up, when I heard of people in my own family, in family circle, my close friends of my parents that got cancer, the next thing the family was hearing was, how long?
For National Cancer Survivor Month this June, the Cancer History Project is continuing its series of conversations with cancer survivors. Dr. Deborah Doroshow, an oncologist and a historian of medicine, is returning as guest editor of the Cancer History Project. In this interview, Doroshow speaks with Marcus Humphrey, who was diagnosed with lymphoma in 2021, and his wife, Mary Humphrey. That winter, Humphrey sought treatment at Medical University of South Carolina Hollings Cancer Center for a swelling that had grown exponentially on the right side of his neck. There, Humphrey was diagnosed with two subtypes of lymphoma, diffuse large B-cell and follicular. Two regimens of chemotherapy failed. Marcus Humphrey's oncologist later said it was the worst case of lymphoma he had ever seen. Humphrey was almost out of options, and his heavy tumor burden made doctors wary of CAR T-cell therapy. Still, Marcus and Mary Humphrey weighed the risks with their team of doctors and went for it. After receiving treatment with CAR T-cell therapy and managing the side effects of neurotoxicity, cytokine release syndrome, and mobility issues, Humphrey's scans are clear. He's vacationing in Italy now and was overlooking the Adriatic Sea with his wife Mary during the following conversation.
Good morning, Mary Marcus. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves?
I'm Marcus Humphrey, and I am sitting here with my bride, Mary. We are getting ready to celebrate this month on the 29th of this month, our 47th anniversary. We are parents to four beautiful children and seven grandchildren.
Wow.
We have a daughter and three sons. And they have given us grand. In my earlier years, prior to meeting Mary, I was second born to mom and dad. My dad was a minister with the AME Church in North Carolina. I grew up as the second oldest. There were three boys and one girl. We lost our sister back in 2006. But I enjoyed a life of good health and strength, and was always very active, energetic, always on the go, never doing anything terribly extreme as our son has. But I did enjoy life. I enjoyed beach walks and hikes and mountain climbing and not extreme climbing, but just going out. Getting out in the outdoors, fishing and boating, swimming, things like that.
Rowing, rowing.
Well, this is earlier, prior to meeting Mary. And then we met in North Carolina. The day that I met her, I pretty much claimed that I was going to marry her. In fact, I was speaking to a third party. A young man that was in our care at a facility that we worked at with special needs individuals. This young man was David, and he had already told Mary that he was going to introduce her as his new girlfriend. But he said, when this guy Marcus gets here, I'm going to introduce you as my new girlfriend. I didn't know all of that until later on, but when he did, I said, you can't. She can't be your girlfriend. He said, why not? And I said, because I'm going to marry her. That was on day one. So here we are.
Now, Mary, was this alarming or charming?
It was alarming and charming. And I was like, in your dreams, buddy.
And Marcus, tell me what you've done for work in the past.
Coming up as a PK, preacher's kid, I found my niche with gosh, all the things that a kid would do, you know, neighborhood lawns, raking yards, and shining shoes as a little black kid, working at a barber shop, making quarters, fill my pockets, you know. And then I decided I wanted to go to school to further my education after high school. To my understanding, I was the first in my family of four kids, including mom and dad, to go to a formal college. That was a little bit of a challenge, but I was determined I was going to make a way of it. Mm-hmm. Had some early failures, but nonetheless, I kind of kept that on the back burner. I'm still going to make it. I'm going to do okay. I'm going to go to college. I met Mary when we were working in North Carolina. And I had been previously working at an institution with cloth. But we worked together at this institution taking care of special needs individuals at a pretty large facility. And I had been there for a number of years. As a matter of fact, I spent 13 years working there. It was one of those things that I think probably looking back, I was somewhat being prepared for work, that kind of work. My sister, being the youngest of the four of us, was born with a handicapping condition. Mm-hmm. And she has cerebral palsy. And the doctors told my parents all the things that my sister would not ever be able to do because of her condition, that she was epileptic and seizures and with a left hand that didn't function fairly well. She would have to learn how to depend on others to do everything for her. All of that, I think, probably prepared me for being compassionate towards others who had conditions that were limiting their ability to enjoy full lives. And it was satisfying to meet this young lady who came to work there and was introduced to me by our supervisor, who says, "I want you to teach her everything you know about your job because she's going to fill the next vacancy." And I said, "Bob, I'm not only going to teach her, I'm going to teach her everything I know, and then I'm going to keep her." So I was making certain that she was hearing me. We worked together with some very close friends, and we carpooled, and then eventually our carpooling gave us exclusivity to each other. And we just ran together and kind of separated ourselves from everybody else.
Work.
Thank
mainly
you.
Been a teacher.
Mostly, yeah, all these years, kind of invested in being an educator. It was one of those things. And got my associates and got my 4-year undergrad work and then 2 masters, and decided, you know, we were pursuing lives as teachers, husband and wife, both of us in early childhood education and elementary. And I enjoyed 5th grade teaching the elementary school kids. They were my niche. And, you know, I went through the earlier grades and I found out I didn't like the kindergarten and I didn't like the 2nd and 3rd grade. I found it with 5th grade. They walked in with an attitude like they knew everything, and it was my job to let them go on thinking that until they realized they needed a teacher. And so that's where I came in. But I enjoyed it immensely. And it was December of 2021 when we parted ways for the Christmas. And I said, "I'll see you all next year." Not knowing, had no idea that the end of December, I would be diagnosed with lymphoma. So that's the introduction to all of that.
So why don't you tell me what happened during that winter break?
During that winter break, we had scheduled time with our families, our kids and their family, our daughter and her children, and Mary and I were planning a trip to Florida Keys. And we had already booked a ticket. Our son had actually in California booked tickets for us to come out there for Christmas and spend Christmas. So the week prior, we went to the Keys with our daughter, Jessica, and her kids. I think just prior to that, and Mary can help me get the details of this correct, I had a small little swelling on the right side of my neck, and I wasn't sure what it was. It would only pronounce itself when I'd lean my neck to the left. And I could feel this little swollen area just kind of concerned me, and I asked if anyone else saw it. I was in the back seat of the car in the passenger, and Mary turned and looked and said, "Oh my, you think we need to turn around and go back home?" And I said, "No, we'll be fine. Well, let's just go on, have a good time." The progression of that was moving pretty rapidly because it affected my general get up and go and have a good time. I was more laid back and not interested in getting in the water once we got there, not interested in a lot of activity with my grandkids.
Which was not typical at all. He typically would have been getting the kids with fishing poles and out in the water with them. And instead he was just being a beach bum with me, which was definitely not typical. I felt like we knew something was wrong. He didn't think it was that serious, I don't think.
And what were you worried about, Mary?
Well, I thought it was cancer. And then my daughter-in-law, who's a nurse, came for Christmas Eve dinner. So we had a big gathering at our house with our kids and grandkids. And she felt of the lump on his neck. And by this time it had grown some and his eyes were swollen. And he was definitely not himself. And she said, "Oh, Dad, you need to get that checked by a specialist. It's whatever it is serious." And it was, for me, that just confirmed my fear about it. But the following day was Christmas Day and we had tickets to California. So we took the plane, got to California. And the first thing my eldest son said when he picked us up at the airport was, "Dad, what is going on with your neck? It had grown that significantly in a week." So I was tremendously worried. Marcus still was not. And then we made it from California, made an appointment with an ear, nose, and throat specialist who thought it was a cyst when we got home. But he scheduled them for a CT scan and a biopsy. So,
and Marcus, I'm wondering when you were in California, Mary said you weren't very concerned. What was going through your head?
I was concerned that this thing had gone from a small, almost a tip of a knuckle on your hand, about that size, on the side of my neck, to where it looked like.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
And
it didn't look quite that big, but that's a little moving. Further along, but it was big.
Yeah. And so then I was, to say I was not concerned at that point, I was concerned, but probably in my gut feeling like this is, this is something that can't be ignored. This is very serious, but I don't want to even entertain the idea that it could possibly be cancer. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody wants to accept the big C, because growing up, when I heard of people in my own family, in family circle, my close friends of my parents that got cancer, the next thing the family was hearing was, how long? And there was nothing in me that wanted to embrace how long. Although I've lived a life of knowing that all of our days are numbered, you know, we are not given eternity here. We're born, we live, we die. But again, I was not a person who was given to illnesses. I'd never been hospitalized all my life, never had any of the childhood diseases, the mumps, the measles, none of those things. And now here I am, a victim to whatever this was. We needed to find out.
When we got back home and went to the ear, nose, and throat specialist, he thought it was a cyst. Mm-hmm. And he gave Marcus the name of some kind of cyst. And Marcus, as a kid, had had a cyst on the side of his head that he had to get lanced from time to time. And so he thought kind of that it coincided with that. And I was convinced that was not correct. So, but he also did schedule him for a CT scan and a biopsy the following week, or that mm-hmm. day he got the CT scan, and then he was to go back for a follow-up. Mm-hmm. And I went back with him when he went for the follow-up. And as soon as the doctor saw him, he said, oh, that's not what I thought it was. And he immediately called in the whole team of, he had some students working with him and his other staff. He had some nurses and a PA, and he called them all in, mm-hmm. did a needle biopsy. And he's looking at the results of the CT scan, and he said, I don't understand why they didn't do contrast. I ordered it. You can see it on my order here. But they didn't do contrast. And then he looks further down the report and he sees that his kidney numbers are extremely high. Mm. So he said, oh, that's why they didn't do contrast, because your kidneys are not in good shape right now. The numbers are very high. And so he did the biopsy, and at 7 a.m. the next morning, I get a call saying, Mary, this is cancer, and it's very aggressive. I don't know what kind. I do know it's very aggressive, and you need to see an oncologist right away. So he recommended that I start making calls, and he said he would start making some calls because it's still holiday time. Mm. Office staff are slim, and we hadn't gone back to school yet. So he called. Neither one of us could reach an oncologist. And finally, late that afternoon, he gets somebody that says, I can see him on the 19th. This was the 12th now. Mm-hmm. So Marcus had gone back to school for a few days. And his school fellow teachers and principal were all like, Marcus, you got to get whatever that is dealt with. You need to take as much time as you need. Get it checked. So,
and can I ask, Mary, it sounds like you were on the other end of the phone when the ear, nose, and throat doctor called and told you that it looked like it was a cancer. And so how did you tell Marcus what you had just learned?
She called me up on the phone.
No.
Yeah, no, upstairs. She called me up.
And no. We were both in our room, okay. In the bedroom.
Okay.
I woke you up.
Okay.
Because you were definitely not feeling yourself. So we'd already decided you weren't going to school. And so I woke you up and told you. And then I started making calls. And I was extremely worried. Marcus still was not until we went back to the ear, nose, and throat specialist. And he told us what he had gotten with this one oncologist that he said, I can see him, but I can't see him until the 19th. This was the 12th. And he said, I told him, I'm afraid this man might not be here on the 19th if we wait till the 19th.
And you were both there to hear him say that?
When Marcus heard that, you say how you did. Do you think that kind of?
Oh, that was definitely very alarming. That to hear, you know, in a 7-day stretch, I might not be here. Again, I think all the things that a healthy individual might imagine. You know, I had this flash of, what could it possibly be? I've never been sick all my life, never been in a hospital. Mm-hmm. I'm a good person. You know, and the things that you just get bombarded with, you're thinking, oh my gosh, 7 days. I'm a decent husband and a father and granddad, and I've got 7 days to think about from here. And I had an emotional flooding, just of tears and sobbing. And Mary went down to talk to the family members. And I had probably about a 5-minute pity party. It felt like I didn't have long to consider what I needed to do. I just knew, growing up in a family of church-minded people and being in a church and being active as a believer, I knew I was not fully in control. It wasn't up to me. I didn't have the final word. And I needed to not forget my foundations. I needed to do a lot of praying and soul seeking and refuse to accept defeat. That's my immediate response.
The ear, nose, and throat specialist got on the phone with the Medical University of South Carolina when he couldn't find an oncologist in Beaufort. That was the earliest that anybody could see him in Beaufort, because basically we were striking out, both of us. So he called the head of the head and neck oncology department at MUSC. And he scheduled them immediately, like that day, for a biopsy, a core biopsy. And he said to Marcus was still concerned about work. And he said, this, your job is not significant right now. Your life is on the line. And he said, you need to get this diagnosed as to what exactly it is and treat it right away. And so we left that day for the Medical University of South Carolina and basically moved into there for about 7 months. It was.
And so what happened when you first got there?
The head and neck gal that was doing the biopsy was brand new to MUSC. She just moved from U of Penn to Charleston. So I immediately had a connection with her because that's who U of Penn is, who repaired my aorta. So she she had a student that was working with her. And so she was teaching the student how to do a core biopsy on Marcus's neck. And it was a little like, oh my gosh, she's teaching somebody else how to do this, which you agree to when you go to a medical university. But it was like, oh, okay, I want them to do it right. And she was quite good though. And she also looked at the CT report and she said, I don't know what kind of cancer this is yet. She said, but I would not ignore this report about your kidneys. She said, I would go to an ER. You could go back to Beaufort, go to the ER there, but you need to know what's going on with his kidneys. And so there we were at an hour and a half from our home in Charleston, already at MUSC. So we said, let's just go to the emergency room here. Mm-hmm. So when we did, they ran all kinds of tests and they admitted him right away. And they knew it was lymphoma probably within that day, but they didn't know what type, what subtype.
Had you, either of you ever heard of lymphoma before?
Yeah, we'd heard of it, but I certainly didn't know. I don't think either of us knew about all the various subtypes that it could have been. And I knew there was Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but I didn't know that out of the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that there could be a myriad of subtypes. So we did not know much about it.
And what did they tell you that day about it?
But basically they told us that they explained what lymphoma was, that it was a blood cancer and that it wasn't like a tumor that you could go in and remove a tumor. And that it typically was treated with chemo, sometimes with radiation. But they also told us that they needed to find out what type, what subtype it was, so that they were using the right protocol of chemo for that particular subtype. And so that was a few days in. And
Marcus, what's going through your head at this point?
I was just wondering if he was going to be able to breathe. I was getting bigger.
I was probably at my worst as a person who was trying to not walk in fear. I was being overcome with fear. Mm. Almost dread. And was having a difficult time to not see anything else. Even though Mary was there for me, I knew our kids were all on red alert. I had their love and support, their prayers, and I had a circle of family or friends that were praying for me. I still was having a difficult time not dealing with the fear. The pain of the swelling on the neck, Mary just said, was so extreme. It was, if you put your pointing finger up about halfway behind your ear, it was pushing up that far behind the ear and down underneath my clavicle. So the picture that I showed you, it was excruciating pain to be in any position except holding my head straight and level, because if any turn or leaning to this side, to the right side, was unbearable. On the pillow at night, I'm trying to stay off the right side, but I'm accustomed to sleeping on my left side, and I can't lay my head over. I'm bracing my head up with a pillow to try to keep the bend from happening there. It quickly interrupted my sleep with headaches that Dr. Hess said were more extreme than the words migraine headache. I've never been prone to a migraine headache, but my younger brother was. And I know the sleepless nights that we all got as family had to endure because of his extreme migraine headaches. And Dr. Hess says, have you ever had migraine? I said, no, but the younger brother did. He said, well, these were more extreme. The headaches you're getting from these are, they measure out more severe than the migraine headache.
One of the things that on the 19th, they still had not fully decided what subtype he had, so they scheduled him to get a full lymph node from his groin. So they were going to do a surgery to get a lymph node, because they said there was conflicting test results. And so now we're at the 19th, which is the day that the ear, nose, and throat specialist has said, I'm afraid this man might not make it to the 19th. And that's the loud noise in my head. And he's scheduled for this surgery, and they're letting me in the waiting room outside the operating room with him till they brought him in. And in comes the anesthesiologist, who specifically works in oncology. And as soon as he sees Marcus, his eyes get huge. And he says, oh my God. He said, this is the kind of thing I get called in the middle of the night for. He said, whatever kind of subtype he's got, he needs treatment to start today. And I was like, I felt this like a wash of relief, that I felt like somebody had seen, like, he's not going to make it if treatment doesn't get underway. And so I felt like he was the one that kind of got the team together to, like, okay, let's go, you know. Mm-hmm. And because by then this mass on his neck was definitely impeding his voice. I felt like he was not going to be breathing soon. And that's basically what the anesthesiologist was saying. And he said, I'm going to have to intubate him. And so I'm like, okay, you know, let's hurry up, get on with this.
Yeah.
And so chemo began on his birthday, January 20th. He was getting birth.
I'm wondering, sorry to interrupt, Mary. I'm wondering what they told both of you about what chemo was going to be like and what to expect and what your thoughts about it were.
I'm sure they probably gave us some introduction. However, my pain threshold was so lacking that I couldn't hear anything. I was dealing with the pain
and the emotion of it.
And whatever was being said in medical terms, I couldn't even get my head wrapped around it, because I was just dealing with it.
They were fabulous. They were giving us printed materials. They knew I was taking notes on everything, and they were definitely giving us quite the education. But I also was aware that Marcus was out of it. He was he was not tuned in. So I knew I had to be kind of doubly tuned in for both of us, because I knew there was going to be this fuzzy period. He was already in this very fuzzy state of, like, he felt like he wasn't there, other than he was in so much pain and so much anxiety. Mm-hmm. So they basically explained the different protocols that they plan to use. They said they would start with R-CHOP. Mm-hmm. And they explained what R-CHOP was. Mm-hmm. They gave us the full definition of all the words and what those medications were.
And had they at this point decided what kind of lymphoma it was?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was diagnosed with two subtypes. So he was diagnosed with diffuse large B cell and follicular lymphoma. Mm-hmm. And they explained that the diffuse large B cell could be treated, and they didn't use the word cured, but they said that the outcome could be very positive, that it might remain in remission, but that follicular was rarely went away. Mm-hmm. Fully went away. So when they did our job, this mass on his neck, by the following day even, had greatly subsided. Wow. And it was like, I felt like it was an answer to prayer, but it was also like, whoa. And so they let us go home, and they said we would be coming back for round two, but well before round two, it was growing again and exponentially. Mm. And so they thought, well, maybe he's gotten an infection from where the biopsy had been done, because it was definitely looking rough where the biopsy had been done. And so they prescribed an antibiotic that seemed to make it worse. And so they prescribed some steroids, which also seemed to make it worse. And so I sent pictures to them through his chart. I'm like, please, it's just not. And they said, oh no, come right back. So we went back. Mm-hmm. And he had, did you have another round of R-CHOP, or did mm-hmm. they go right to rice?
I think they did twice on the R-CHOP.
Yeah, I think they did too.
So I know they, each time we had an infusion, there was an after effect of the chemo. Mm-hmm. You know, stuff that people don't want to hear about. They don't ever want to experience it. Now I was having to experience it because I was faced with the
that or die.
Yeah.
How was the chemo making you feel?
Sick on the stomach, lethargic, the headache, I think, was attributed to the swelling. I'm not so sure it was not somewhat contributed by the chemo.
Because they also gave him
very dry
chemo in his spine to help avoid any passage to the brain. So that I felt like he was just poked and prodded, and they had to move the port from one side to the other. So there was a lot of,
You know, when you're, well, you don't know, but when you're there and you're the patient and you're dealing with all of this bombardment of different reactions to medications that's going into your body, and you've never experienced any of it before, and you're trying to figure out, why am I feeling this way and why am I feeling that way, and I can't separate any of it. It's all hitting me at one time, and I'm having these feelings of gastro issues, and I'm feeling like, okay, I'm going to get sick on the stomach, and I've got an extreme case of diarrhea coming on here, and all of a sudden I've got to urinate, even though I feel like I just filled up that bottle that they gave me, but I've got to go again, and they're pushing the water, and then all of a sudden my system is shutting down. I can't urinate. They do a catheter, and this catheter is not working, and then I finally get a nephrostomy.
Nephrostomy tubes in his kidneys.
Inside, both sides. And I'm having to deal with the reality of my organs not functioning. And again, for someone who'd never been hospitalized and never been sick, I'm wondering, is the end here just, are they just delaying the end? We're going to get to the end of this episode of chemo, and then I'm done. Because I didn't feel like physically I had any more fight left in me.
And then they started rice, which that to me, that just wiped him out. Like he almost immediately lost about 60 pounds, 60, 65, and he was never fat man. When we got married, he was one of these guys that would drink things to gain weight and muscle. He was not one of those that ever had the battle of the bulge like his lovely bride does. He was always in good shape, mostly muscle too. And so it wasn't like when he lost weight, it wasn't like he'd lost fat. He lost muscle mass.
If in my good days, if I lost 5 pounds, I was concerned.
Yeah. So when he lost so much weight, he lost all his hair when he went through rice too. And he really, I know no other way to describe it other than he looked like somebody that had been through the Holocaust. He looked like a skeleton. It was so, so scary to see him. But it was scary. That was very, very scary.
Yeah.
And it's especially scary seeing that it wasn't working. Because by then, they had very carefully explained, well, what if chemo doesn't work? What do you do? And also by then, some of the lymphoma that was in behind his eye had begun to push on his optic nerve. And so he was really still having these terrible headaches, and his vision was starting to be impacted. So they had decided they were going to...
Well, they referred us out to
an eye specialist who specialized, though, in oncology.
Yeah, and he said, after several testings, he said if this continues the way it's going right now, we may end up having to take their eye. So again, to multiply the already dismal picture here, I can't imagine me having a sustained life with this little frail body that was looking like a toothpick now. I had issues before. Again, if I lost 5 pounds, I felt like, But now to be so frail, and then to think, you're going to take my eye out, and how long am I going to have these recurrences of these headaches that won't let me sleep at night, and all this other stuff, and these tubes hanging out my backside. And, it's like life had been diminished, so extremely diminished that, it was almost taking my desire away. But
so
I've been a fighter all my years. I just have been that person. I was a runt in my family, and my mom's sisters made comments, derogatory ones, about my size, because they were all suffering from obesity, and I was a little tiny skinny kid who couldn't get any weight on it. And they would make comments and snicker about me, and it gave me an inferiority complex and, things like that. And then you're thinking, okay, here's what I'm reduced to. Why? But anyway, you have to go along with some other questions.
So I will add too in here that even though he may have been feeling like that, he wasn't sounding like that. Mm-hmm. So anybody else that was coming in with any kind of fear or negativity, he wasn't hearing
I was
it.
Telling them, don't bring that in here. Don't bring it
so
in
he,
here.
So he was speaking very positively with a lot of hope. And fortunately, the floor that we were on at MUSC, the oncology floor, is filled with some of the most amazing people I've ever met. And they were so full of hope and continually encouraging and praying and kind words and cheerful and would tell jokes and turn things to make them funny. And so along the way, and we had a wonderful support from family and friends that would come and visit. And so even though we were still on the edge of COVID restrictions, they did allow visitors, they did allow him to see other people, which really made a huge difference. So I think those encouraging words, and if I would get freaked out or scared, he would be the one telling me not to worry. So yeah, so he, even though he may have been worrying himself, he wasn't voicing it. He wasn't giving lip service to worry and fear. He was giving it to faith and encouragement and just being very positive, even when I could tell he felt like crap and worse. So anyway.
What happened next?
Well, when he was going through Rice, they had, even before he actually started on Rice, they did explain CAR T, and they explained what it was and what the process of it was, and that in order to even get approval to go through CAR T, you had to have two different types of chemo fail. Mm-hmm. And so they said, if that happens, then you can get approved. And so I was asking questions very directly, like, what is that about? Is that an insurance issue or what is that? And they said, yes, partially. It's very expensive. And so it won't get approved unless chemo fails, because it's more expensive than chemo. And I said, but the chances of it working are higher than chemo, sounds like. And they said, yeah. And I said, well, I hope at some point in time they'll start using that as first instead of last resort. Mm-hmm. So when they realized that Rice was also failing, they started giving us more preparation for CAR T.
Now, were either of you guys looking any of this up on the internet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was, and they'd given us a book about CAR T. Mm-hmm. And So I'd read all of it and read more and interviewed people and knew people that were involved in cancer treatment. And so I started doing a lot of research about it. And Marcus read the first page in the book that they gave us, and he read the sentence that said might cause death, and he closed the book, put it aside. So I had come to the place where I realized that if he didn't get some kind of treatment that worked, that the cancer was going to kill him. And he had such a heavy tumor load that his oncologist, Dr. Hess, really had a lot of second thoughts about whether or not to go with CAR T, because he felt that it could kill him. Mm-hmm. And or that it could leave him very severely brain damaged. Mm-hmm. And I think we all got to the place where we knew that if they didn't go that route, that he wasn't going to make it. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was with a lot of trepidation that he did decide to go through with it. Mm-hmm. And the gal that coordinated, the nurse practitioner that is the CAR T coordinator at MUSC, she's an amazing lady too, Colleen. She was very hopeful. And there was another oncologist that was one of the attending physicians on the seventh floor there at MUSC. So he saw Marcus pretty regularly too. Mm-hmm. Hashmi.
Oh yeah.
And although Nepali is probably one of my favorite doctors, he saw him a lot while we were there on the seventh floor. But Hashmi was very fast, like strictly business kind of guy, but he had a lot of confidence about outcomes with CAR T. He had seen some real positive results. So I remember one day he came in because they definitely determined that Rice was not doing it. And he said, oh, it's all right. He said, you're going to go through CAR T. And he said, that stuff is like Pac-Man. He's going to go in there and find all that lymphoma and eat it up. He said, with this chemo, he said, you're in there with a hammer. What's it called? What's that game?
Whack-a-mole.
Whack-a-mole. It's like whack-a-mole. You hit it one place, it pops up in another. Mm-hmm. He said, but with CAR T, it's like Pac-Man, goes in and eats it up. So as much as I had read about CAR T, I don't think mentally either one of us were prepared for the intensity of how intense it was.
And it Marcus, was. What was your experience with CAR T?
Yeah. Well, Mary has already said, you know, when I opened the book up and I read the first page or second page, whatever it was on, all the precautions and the, you know, things that to look forward to, because I needed to know. I needed to know what was going in the body, even though it's not something I was familiar with. I just wanted to have some kind of knowledge and be able to articulate in a conversation or even hear a conversation and know what was going on. Mm-hmm. And say, okay, that's why I'm feeling this way. It's because of this. It's because of that. And this is something they say you might expect. So that's why I'm feeling this way. I eventually picked that book back up and read it from front cover to back and again and again, and then became acutely aware and tuned in to conversations when the teens would come in and have conversations. And then all of a sudden, when the things start happening, like my craving for, I couldn't get enough water in my system. And I was asking for not just tap water. I wanted ice water. I needed ice water. And I needed it with ice in it. I was losing my appetite with this CAR T, and no food had any appeal whatsoever. You know, my taste buds were shot. My sense of smell was shot. I couldn't smell it. And I can remember feeling like if I were losing weight, I needed to eat. I knew that. Mm-hmm. But food that Mary was coming in and ordering, did you order lunch yet? Did you order breakfast? Did you order dinner? And she would be lickety-split on it, making a phone call, and then we'd wait for the hour, and then the food would show up, and then I had no interest in eating it. You know, I'm feeling like I've got to eat. And I'm hearing her saying, you've got to eat. And I'm like, I know. Well, you got to have some fruit if you don't have something else. And I remember so clearly having a bowl of red grapes because I could get just a little taste of the red grapes, not the white grapes. I couldn't taste them. I couldn't taste the eggs or any of the things on the menu, but the red grapes, they seemed to give me a little flavor. But I can remember having one grape that I was chewing on. It seemed to have been 5 to 10 minutes of chewing one grape, trying to make it go down, and I couldn't. And it was like, all of a sudden, again, one of the adverse realities of this whole treatment was kicking in. And it's like, okay, it's not that people give up the will to eat. They want to eat. But if I'm eating and everything I'm eating is, I'm losing it back to the bathroom. And now I have no taste for it and I can't smell it. And so what's the purpose? You know, mm-hmm. It's like, okay, you got too many negatives coming at you in one direction. And then you're like, okay, I've got to be able to move around, but I'm so weak, I can't get out of bed. In fact, during this CAR T, I was immobilized. I couldn't.
Couldn't walk. He couldn't talk.
I lost my ability to give you my name and date of birth. I couldn't count as a teacher, tenured teacher. I couldn't count from 100 to zero by tens. And they're coming in there and they're asking that I go through this. And I'm looking and pleading with Mary with my eyes and hearing their words saying, she can't help you. But my eyes are pleading with my wife, please give me the first number. Hmm.
What do they call it? Cytokine release syndrome and the neurotoxicity that kicked in like day two after CAR T was far more intense than I had anticipated. And I was realizing that the big fears and the concerns of why they even were hesitant to maybe do CAR T. He wound up in ICU, didn't know his name, didn't know his birthday, couldn't formulate a sentence, couldn't walk or talk or move an arm or leg. And that was extremely frightening. And then he wound up, even once he got out of ICU, he wound up with this head full of what do they call these? The patches where they check for seizure activity, the EEG, but it was hooked to a camera that was observing 24/7 of seizure activity, or really any activity around him. So anybody doing anything, saying anything to him, him doing or saying anything, was being videoed. And that was very intense, because I could tell he was really struggling during that time too, because he was definitely not with it at all. And I kept wondering, is this it? Is this going to be it? And that part, I didn't feel prepared for, even though I read that this could be, but there were two nurses that had worked with a lot of patients that had been through CAR-T. And both of them kept encouraging me and saying, we've seen this before. We've seen it before. He's going to come around. And they were really very good about reporting everything and recording everything and letting his doctor know exactly what was going on. So I felt like his doctor was so carefully observing just the right amount of steroids to give or not give. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things they had explained was that steroids can kind of eliminate the positive effects of CAR-T, but also they can help manage the CRS, the yeah. neurotoxicity. So that having that head knowledge was very helpful. But really, I think for me, the very helpful part was those nurses that kept saying, we've seen this, he'll come out of it. And they kept like trying to really, they took such good care of him. And they were so, so attentive. And they really took care of me too.
They gave me a kind of I showed you the picture. Even though I had all those wires and taps attached to my head, and I couldn't tell you my name and date of birth. That was awful. I still managed to try to keep that face on that gave her hope. You know, I just couldn't. I remember at one point early on, I was there at the hospital, and she and my daughter called me, and they were going to do a FaceTime call, and I was going through the thick of it on the negative side, and I just couldn't bring myself to allow them to see me in so much tormenting pain. And I just refused the phone call. I mean, you know, I answered and said, I'm sorry, you know, why don't you get on the phone? I'm not, you can't see me like this. I'm hanging up. Bye. No, don't hang up. I'm hanging up now. Bye. Going from that to now coming out of this CAR-T and dealing with not just the effects of the chemo, but CAR-T had a twist all its own that was, I smelled like CAR-T. It poured out of my pores, you know, and the smell of it, the taste of it was in my mouth. I couldn't get rid of it. It was one of those.
It was a lifesaver.
Yeah. Yeah.
When did things start to turn the corner?
I would say probably towards the end of June. Mm-hmm. I started feeling some more hope anyway. And Marcus seemed, because for quite a while, like he could not walk. And so to see him so debilitated was just very frightening. But I would say by the end of June, he was getting released to go to, for us, there's a Hope Lodge. Mm-hmm. You familiar with Hope Lodge?
Yeah.
The first one in the country was actually started by a woman in Charleston who was a Holocaust survivor and worked at the Hope Lodge till she was 103. Just quite a story if you ever get a chance to read up on it. So the Hope Lodge in Charleston is right across from MUSC. And so by the end of June, they had released us to go stay at Hope Lodge. And once we were there, even though like he couldn't do the stairs, he couldn't, you know, they have an elevator, mm-hmm. but he could get with a walker from the elevator to our bedroom. And we started seeing, once he was there, we started seeing some progress. And he was able to have more visitors there too, which was nice. And they had this great big porch, big open screen porch that you could have like gatherings on. So our big family would come and we could even get do a few little short outings. So we went with the grandkids to the aquarium and to the beach. And they had one of those wheelchairs with the big fat tires.
Mm-hmm.
So we wheeled them out on the beach. My son wheeled them out on the beach. And I saw him begin to start making some turns. My sister and brother-in-law came and several family members, several of his brother and my sister-in-law and a lot of family, and a lot of friends, which I think that made a huge difference. And so we started seeing some real positive progress. And then I want to say it was like, I feel like it was right around the 4th of July. I think it was the 4th or 5th. Maybe 6th of July that they let us go home. And I think that to me, we live in a 4-story townhome. And our daughter at the beginning of COVID went through a divorce and she and her 3 kiddos live with us. Mm-hmm. So I think being around them and then we have an elevator in our home and our bedroom's on the 4th floor. So he could be in his own bed, come up and down,
mm-hmm.
you know, be around family. And there's a pool. So I almost made him like go out to the pool. You got to go.
Marcus, how are you feeling around this time?
I dreaded the walk out to the pool because it was such an ordeal. Physically, you know, you're taking baby steps and I'm thinking, okay, I'm dealing with the neuropathy in my left side that was still an issue. And I couldn't bring my fingers together. I couldn't make a fist with my left hand. And I'm thinking, it doesn't make sense to go out there and with all this weight loss and looking frail and try to imagine me putting on a swimsuit and being visible out there to my community. You know, it was a mind, a big negative. And thinking, okay, once I'm in the pool, then what? It's not like I'm going to be swimming. I can't. You know, I keep thinking, I can't. But at the same time, I'm looking at her and I'm thinking, she's such a fighter for me that I can't disappoint her. I can't at least try. And so I get out in the pool and I just kept the shirt on and my swim shorts. And once I was lowered on the pool deck and just kind of dropped my bottom in there, holding on to the side, I could kick my legs. And it was good therapy. And then I could, it was a gradual pool. So you could walk in and not have any drop offs. And you could go as deep as you want. I'd get to where I could sit and the water would be at my chest. And I just moving my arms left and right, front to back and side. And, you know, it's like, okay, trying to pull water with a hand that looked like this for pulling on the right side was great, but then to do it on the left side, and it's like, okay, you can't pull water when your fingers are separated like that. Mm-hmm. All it's doing is just, it's to no avail. Anyway, I kept hearing her encouraging words, and I kept seeing her encouragement and hearing her tone, and she was relentless, and I knew it was for my best. And so, you know, okay, got to keep this girl happy. I got to be around.
When did you start hearing from your doctors that they really felt that this was working and that things were going in a better direction?
They were so encouraged to hear that I had been in a pool.
So, and they were also, the staff at Hope Lodge were such a delightful group of people. I feel like we made lifelong friends there.
Oh, for sure.
But one of the things they do, they have a fundraiser. There's a semi-pro team in Charleston, baseball team. And one of their fundraising events, they raise money for Hope Lodge and Ronald McDonald House and MUSC. And they did a big fundraising event at the beginning of the ball game, one of the ball games. And they asked Marcus to be their starting pitcher. And that was in July. And he was still needing a walker and definitely not feeling strong. But so we told Dr. Hess about it. And he's like, yeah, I guess you could do that. Just be really careful. It's hot out there. And maybe, okay. And so he okayed it. And then he came to the game. And Marcus.
Such support.
And Marcus, we wound up getting where we parked. He had to walk quite a ways. Oh. And it was blazing hot. And
just to get to the building, and then from the building there
to
was
get out to the pitcher's mound.
There was no gators to give me transport. There was no wheelchairs for anybody to push me in. So I'm pushing my walker.
Until afterwards, then they found a wheelchair. But anyway, one of my brothers came to the game, and they helped him get out to the pitcher's mound.
Yeah.
And
you helped.
Yeah, and I helped a little bit. You fussed at me. Anyway, he winds up to make his pitch, and then they call the pitch over the loudspeaker. They said, oh, that looked like a strike to me. Oh, no. That did not look like a strike to me, but it was fun. So I think that positive encouragement really started to kick in and help. And his medical team, the doctors, the nurse practitioner, Lindsay, all of them, they're his pharmacist. Everybody would gather whenever he had an appointment, gather and just come and be encouragers. So they've really been fabulous.
And just the fact that they did, Debbie, it was not only encouraging to me, it was also, I could see that it was having such a positive effect on Mary.
Mm.
And I wasn't going to trade that in for anything. I'd seen her and encouraged her to not worry, not to worry, not to worry. And at a point when she could leave my room, and I was encouraging her because she would get a hotel room within walking distance. And I'd say, "You're not sleeping here on that little couch tonight. You need to go get a good night's rest." And finally convincing her that I would be fine until she came back the next morning, but seeing her walk in and be greeted with all the supporting staff, it just kind of gave her that hope.
Yeah.
It just really encouraged me all the more to just keep on keeping on and not give up the fight and see that not only were these encouraging words, but they were feeding my spirit and hers that, yeah, we're going to make it.
One of the things Marcus had been the associate pastor at our church for a lot of years, and we go to a small vineyard church, and just a few months before Marcus's diagnosis, our pastor and very good friend of 20 years had moved out of the community, taken a job with Samaritan's Purse as a chaplain, and so we lost a key mm-hmm. friend. Didn't lose him, but you know, he was a distance away now. But Marcus had a really good support system in not just our church, but other churches in town, and people that really reached out to him were part of an international Bible study group and have friends that are in Europe and friends that are in the States that are part of that group. And so many of them reached out and would come and pray for the doctors, pray for the nurses, pray for us. And we had a lot of prayer support. And I really feel like God made such a difference in having faith in God and his ability, just from my perspective, even to give some people, the scientists that came up with the ideas of CAR T, you know, or chemo, the you know, watching that process of how they've developed this machine that hooks into a patient's neck and draws out blood, but then separates just the T cells out of that blood, and then to send it off to be boosted up with chimeric antigen receptors. I was like, what? Who even thought of that? Yeah. You know, to me, there's like so many miraculous things that happen as a result of people wanting to help heal other people. That I think that can't be discounted for the amount of, you know, I think too, being on a floor where you see people that are dying, that they're, you know, these are their last days, or they've been battling a disease that has gotten the best of them. And to see the difference that friends and family and people that are praying and people that are encouraging make in somebody's recovery, it is profound to witness that. And so I feel like that's been an integral part of our journey. And Marcus has had the opportunity to go and speak at several different churches in our community, people that have been praying for him, and he's gotten up and not only told people what his good doctors have done, but also what the great physician has done, and that he's really a miracle story, because I feel like CAR T is a miracle thing. It's, you know, like who would even, like, what did somebody have a dream about that? Like, you know, just
absolutely. Absolutely.
Here's a picture, Debbie. This was in January when they showed us a real picture of not just a swelling on the neck that we could see, mm-hmm. but they did a scan to show the aggression of the cancer and how mm-hmm. far spread it was. Mm-hmm. At one point, when they gave words to it to make us know how extreme it was, very much later when we could hear it, the doctor says, I didn't want to say this back then when you were in the middle of all of it, but you had the worst case of lymphoma I have ever seen.
Wow.
Here's all the black.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then after the CAR T, this is a side-by-side scan. Then, trying to give you a clear picture.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So you see different. My organs, my brain, my heart, my kidneys, yeah. and my bladder. And the cancer was nowhere to be seen.
So his last three scans have been clear.
December.
So.
And February.
Yeah. So that one of the things that Dr. Hess told us, each one, the risks of it returning diminish greatly. Mm-hmm. So there's also a lot of hope. And then the, you know, this amazing gift that we were given of being able to make this trip has been pretty phenomenal.
And I'll just tell listeners that I learned that you guys are on a 5-month wonderful trip all around the world, and you're currently in Italy, where you seem to be having the time of your lives, which is absolutely marvelous.
We're looking out the window here over the Adriatic Sea.
Mm. So
I'm very jealous. Mary, Marcus, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking time on this marvelous trip to tell us all about both of your experiences. It was incredibly meaningful, and I know that others will really benefit from hearing about.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity.
Your story.
And thank you for the work you do. Thank you for devoting your life.
It's our pleasure to work with fantastic people like you.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast. Podcasts of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @cancerhistproj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.